This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, U.S. Democratic Party presidential contenders get ready to hold their first debate. A new accusation of war crimes in Yemen. Elephants may help find a cancer cure for humans.
We were able to take our elephants, and we have 43 elephants altogether, so we're able to look at the different age groups and test the theory of how this gene works depending on the age of the elephant.
The Grateful Dead is very much alive. These stories are more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. U.S. voters will have their first look at Democrat presidential hopefuls answering and debating questions as they gather later Tuesday in Las Vegas, Nevada. While the Republicans still have a crowded field seeking their party's nomination, the Democrats have just five in the race. Because debates often provide unpredictable moments, there is no sure bet who will emerge as the perceived winner, and the strategies could be surprising as to who will gamble or play it safe in Las Vegas. As VOA senior political correspondent Jim Malone tells International Edition host Susan Yockey, there is a lot at stake, especially for the top two candidates.
They're high for all of the candidates involved, particularly for Hillary Clinton, who's been leading the pack. For Bernie Sanders, the surprising surging candidate, the Vermont senator, who's done very well, especially in some early states that vote, like Iowa and particularly in New Hampshire, where he's leading Hillary Clinton at the moment. And also, there's three other candidates that are going to be in the debate. This is their moment to maybe break through. I'm talking about the former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley, the former Virginia Senator Jim Webb, and the former Governor of Rhode Island, Lincoln Chafee.
Do you think there will be some tough questioning and talking, or might the candidates be a little easy on each other for the sake of the party in the long run? And after all, they just want to get the White House.
That's actually a good question, because what we've noticed so far is Bernie Sanders has done very well, but there have been no attacks from the Clinton campaign. That's by design. Mm-hmm. They don't want to alienate those Sanders supporters because she'd like to count on them later on, assuming that she becomes the nominee. So will we see a change in strategy in the debate by the Clinton camp, trying to draw more of a contrast with Bernie Sanders, who has described himself as a democratic socialist? And many people who go to his rallies are enthralled by the Sanders candidacy and his focus on the income gap among Americans, the very wealthy, and the rest of the population struggling. So it's going to be a test not only for Clinton, but for Sanders. Can he broaden his appeal? And, of course, for the other three in the debate, can they even get on the radar? Because right now the only people mattering who have announced are Clinton and Sanders.
And we have seen the Republicans really going after each other.
We have. You know, this is the first Democratic debate. We've already had a couple on the Republican side. That has had the effect of shooting Donald Trump up to the top spot. But it's also scrambled the race because you have many other people jockeying for position in the Republican field. We have 15 total candidates. One day Jeb Bush is up. The next day he's down. Carly Fiorina, Ben Carson are up. So there's quite a bit of uncertainty on the Republican side. There is uncertainty on the Democratic side, but the players are pretty well known for the moment, primarily Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders.
Well, Clinton has been trying to clean up her image lately.
Yes, she's, of course, dealing with questions about her trustworthiness, particularly as it relates to how she comes across to voters, but also this controversy over her use of private email account while Secretary of State.
And I noticed she recently brought out the big gun, and that being her husband, the former President Bill Clinton.
Yeah, we're seeing a little bit more of him. I mean, I think for a long time she wanted to make it clear that she's running on her own. She said, "I'm not running for a third Bill Clinton term. I'm running for my own first term." She's also said, "I'm not running for a third Barack Obama term." And what we've seen of late is her putting some distance between herself and Barack Obama on things like Syria. She's arguing for a no-fly zone in Syria. She would take a more muscular approach in some foreign policy areas. So that may come out in the debate as well. So you could have Hillary Clinton not only drawing distinctions with Bernie Sanders, but with the current president of the United States and her one-time political rival going back to 2008.
VOA senior political correspondent Jim Malone speaking with International Edition Susan Yockey. Some questions remain if the Democrats could be jolted by a sudden announcement by Vice President Joe Biden. Some in the party are hoping Mr. Biden will decide to run for president because of two potentially damaging issues facing Hillary Clinton: the deadly 2012 attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, Libya, and her handling of sensitive official emails on a personal server. Both occurred while she served as Secretary of State for President Obama. Turning now to what's buzzing online for the upcoming debate, here's social media correspondent G. Abby Lee with the latest. Hi, G.
Hi, Ray.
Well, tell us, what's the trending hashtag?
Well, the most popular one is hashtag DemDebate, and the Topsy Analytics website shows that hashtag was used in almost 6,000 tweets in the last 24 hours. And like you said earlier, there are only five presidential hopefuls from the Democratic side. On the stage, the highest polling candidate, of course, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, will be in the middle. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley will be seated next to her, and the two others, Jim Webb and Lincoln Chafee, will be on either ends.
Now let's focus now on the two main contenders. Mm-hmm. First of all, what's Mrs. Clinton saying on Twitter?
She's been tweeting a lot today, and her latest tweet reads like this: "Thoughts and prayers aren't enough. We must act to protect families from gun violence." She's on Twitter at Hillary Clinton.
Well, Hillary Clinton's had a lot of titles. Mm-hmm. What does her account description say?
A lot, and it says wife, mom, grandma, women and kids advocate, FLOTUS, senator, secretary of state, hair icon, pantsuit aficionado, 2016 presidential candidate.
Well, that's quite a resume, if that's what you want to call it. A mouthful, too. What about Sanders?
He has two accounts, both verified. The older account is his senator account, and the handle is at SEN Sanders. The tweets are from his staffer, unless signed with letter B. The other account, created in 2010, is the account he uses for a presidential campaign, and that account's handle is at Bernie Sanders.
So which one do you recommend to our listeners?
Well, it depends on what you want to get out of it. So the first account is more about Bernie Sanders, the man, and what he stands for, and the latter has more tweets on how his campaign is going and clips from his tours. Ray?
Social media reporter G. Abby Lee, and you can follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. That's spelled J-E-E-A-B-B-E-Y-L-E-E. And this is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, the host for Jazz America, where each week we give you the best of jazz past and present and conversation with the music makers. You can hear the program online at voanews.com and on the air on VOA each Saturday and Sunday at 13 hours Universal Time. Join me for Jazz America and help me celebrate the greatness of a century of jazz. Listen at 13 hours Universal Time Saturdays and Sundays on voanews.com and the Voice of America.
Listening to VOA's International Edition. In Turkey, funerals are being held for the 97 victims of last Saturday's double bombing at a peace rally in the capital, Ankara. Turkish authorities are trying to identify two suspected suicide bombers. As Dorian Jones reports from one of the funerals in Istanbul, along with grief, there is growing anger.
Hundreds of people gathered at a mosque for the funeral of the 55-year-old Tayfun Kamal Benol, one of the victims in Saturday's twin bombings. The funeral was one of nearly a dozen held across Istanbul for those killed by the bombings. As Benol's coffin was carried away, people clapped in solidarity. paper signs attached to the clothing of some mourners read, "We are sorry, we are angry, we are mourning, we are in rebellion." One of the attendees, a banker who identified herself as Junsai, voiced her opinion about who was responsible for Saturday's attack.
Who killed them? They want to kill all of us because we want to peace. State is, of course, responsible for this. They have to have security for people, but they haven't. I'm afraid, I'm upset. I can't believe it.
As they departed, some mourners chanted, "Murdering state, murdering government," a common slogan now heard across the country. The government faces increasing accusations of negligence, if not collusion, in Turkey's worst terrorist attack, charges it vehemently denies. The main opposition parties are blaming the government policy of backing radical Islamist groups fighting the Syrian government for contributing to the attack. Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu declared the Islamic State group is the prime suspect, and authorities are close to identifying one of the bombers. Dozens of suspected Islamic State militants have been arrested, but it's not clear if they are connected to the bombing. Doreen Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
Saudi Arabia's King Salman rejected any suggestions that his country should give up its role as the organizer of the Hajj following last month's deadly stampede. The Saudi monarch said irresponsible comments and criticism against the kingdom's handling of security during the Hajj will not affect his country's oversight of the annual Islamic pilgrimage. The official Saudi death toll remains 769, but a new estimate based on an Associated Press count suggests that 1,480 people died in the stampede. This new number would make it the deadliest catastrophe in the history of the event. The Saudi-led coalition airstrikes against Houthi rebels in Yemen are in the bullseye of Amnesty International. The human rights group is calling the action war crimes, responsible for the deaths of hundreds of civilians in residential areas. Henry Ridgewell has more.
Amnesty International looked into 13 airstrikes carried out between May and July by the Saudi-led coalition around the northern Houthi stronghold of Sadr. Amnesty's Rasha Mohammed says 100 civilians, including 59 children, were killed.
In one direct airstrike we looked into and visited the site in July, there were a cluster of 9 houses, and there were 4 consecutive airstrikes that were spaced out over 2 hours. 55 people were killed, 35 of which were children under the age of 11.
Amnesty also claims to have found the remains of cluster munitions banned under international treaties. Saudi Arabia did not respond directly to Amnesty's accusations, but has said in the past that it only targets rebel fighters and denies using cluster bombs. Again, Rasha Mohammed of Amnesty.
We're asking for all states to, first of all, suspend, and specifically the US, the arms transfer to all members of the coalition, given that there are war crimes being committed, and two, for the international community to investigate these war crimes.
The United Nations Human Rights Body issued a report last month detailing alleged violations of international law by all sides in the conflict. Rupert Colville is the body's spokesperson.
The report does not at any point accuse the coalition forces of deliberately targeting civilians and civilian infrastructure, although it does catalogue several specific incidents involving airstrikes that caused large numbers of civilian casualties.
In the 6 months since April, the United Nations says more than 2,350 civilians have been killed in the conflict. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Gunmen riding a motorbike in southern Afghanistan shot and killed a doctor Monday who worked for the United Nations Assistance Mission. There's been no claim of responsibility. The southern Afghan region is considered a Taliban heartland. The recent upturn in insurgent attacks across the country has led the UN to relocate its local and expatriate staff from several offices to relatively safer areas in Afghanistan. The assassination of the doctor came 2 days after the U.S. Embassy in Kabul warned of attacks against the UN headquarters or possibly its offices in the Afghan capital on or about October 12th. While there are many problems facing Afghanistan's government and people, a group of academics in the U.S. Midwest city of Omaha, Nebraska, is trying to maintain a strong faith in the country's future through programs to improve education. VOA's Greg Flakes has details.
Since 1972, the University of Nebraska at Omaha has helped Afghanistan through its Afghanistan Studies Center. Assistant Director Abdul Rahim Yassir helped create and distribute nearly 16 million textbooks for the country's impoverished schools.
So our books were distributed all over the country. They were even used by the Taliban during their era because it was so relevant to the needs of the people.
One of the students who learned from those books and later came to Omaha to study is the center's new director, Sherjan Ahmadzai. The center also trained Afghan teachers.
Most of them were women who came here, got trained, got to know about new methodologies, and went back and trained their fellow teachers.
Under the Taliban, girls were denied education and women were barred from teaching. But women are now a strong force in education. But Ahmadzai says progress is threatened by the violence and poverty that turns Afghans into refugees to Europe.
The second biggest population of those migrants or refugees are Afghans after Syrians. So that gives you a sense of idea what is the situation in Afghanistan.
Still, Sherjan Ahmadzai remains optimistic for his country's future.
The overall picture or the direction Afghanistan is going is a positive and constructive in the long term.
And he says the Afghan Studies Center has had a local impact, helping students, faculty, and many residents of Omaha to better understand Afghanistan's people and their struggle to create a better future. Greg Flakus, VOA News, Omaha, Nebraska.
Coming up, how elephants might help in the fight against cancer. This is VOA.
Greenbeat, for a healthier planet.
Farm animals are among the world's biggest polluters. Cow dung, for example, contains about 60% methane.
Manure is the ultimate recycling product.
Bill Harkey is with Rosendale Dairy Farm in Wisconsin and says the company is dedicated to sustainability. Rosendale has partnered with a biogas company to turn the manure's methane into electricity.
The majority of our manure goes to the biodigester, and they will take the gases out of it that they can turn into green energy, and then we will get the manure back.
And from that comes another byproduct.
We bring in a lot of recycled products to feed the cows, if you will, and the cows in turn will produce a very nutrient-rich fertilizer.
Rosendale cuts its carbon footprint even further by delivering the fertilizer through a nearly 13-kilometer-long pipeline.
That's helped us reduce the number of truck rolls by about 40,000.
And the cows, well, they seem pretty content with the whole thing. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Green Beat.
This is VOA's International Edition. It's long been said that elephants never forget. Whether you believe that or not, here's something about elephants you might not forget. Some scientists say elephants might someday save the lives of children with a rare disease that causes cancer. It turns out elephants rarely get the disease because they are genetically protected against this common killer of humans. Here's VOA's Jessica Berman.
It's a matter of numbers, all things being equal. Bigger animals with more cells should have a higher chance of getting cancer, but it doesn't work that way. Huge animals like the elephant have only a 5% chance of developing cancer in their lifetimes, compared to an 11 to 25% chance for humans. That's because they have a surplus of so-called P53 genes, well-defined tumor suppressor genes, which put the brakes on the rapid abnormal cell growth that's the hallmark of cancer. Elephants have 20 copies of the guardian gene. In contrast, humans only have one working copy of P53. One portion of our gene is inherited from the mother, the other allele from the father. If either of the DNA fragments becomes damaged, the risk of cancer increases dramatically. Wendy Kiso is an elephant conservation scientist at the Ringling Brothers Center for Elephant Conservation, operated by the Ringling Brothers Circus, and co-author of a study looking at the protective effects of the elephant's P53 genes.
So what was great with this study is we were able to take our elephants, and we have 43 elephants altogether, so we're able to look at the different age groups and test the theory of how this gene works depending on the age of the elephant.
Kiso and colleagues at the University of Utah and Utah's Hogel Zoo irradiated white blood cells taken from the Asian elephants to see how P53 worked, comparing it to the tumor-suppressing activity in humans.
So what was great with this study is we were able to take our elephants, and we have 43 elephants altogether, so we're able to look at the different age groups and test the theory of how this gene works depending on the age of the elephant.
The P53 genes in the elephant samples made damaged cells twice as likely to stop reproducing and die as normal cells. The results of the study are published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Researchers hope they can use the information from elephant experiments to help children with a rare inherited condition called Leframini syndrome, in which one copy of the P53 gene is damaged. Children and adults with Leframini have a 90% lifetime risk of developing cancer. Joshua Schiffman, an oncologist at the University of Utah's Huntsman Cancer Institute, oversaw the study. Schiffman says actual elephant genes may someday be saving people's lives.
Again, it sounds a bit like science fiction, but we know that there are ways. There's new nanotechnology that's out there, and there are ways of delivering certain types of genes or proteins to various cells in the body. And so now we are working with collaborators from across the globe, really, to try to figure out, is there a role for these elephant P53 genes to actually be put into people?
Experts think elephants have so many P53 genes because they grow explosively from calves into adults, with the genes preventing development of cancer in their rapidly dividing cells, although further research is needed to establish this. Without a surplus of these tumor suppressor genes, they speculate that elephants might go extinct. With enough funding, Schiffman hopes research can begin on using elephant DNA to stop cancer from growing in people. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
If you thought you'd heard the last live performances from the iconic jam group, The Grateful Dead, think again. Three of the original group members are teaming up with singer John Mayer for a tour called Dead and Company. As International Edition's David Byrd tells us, the tour came about when Mayer met some of the group members while hosting a talk show.
Last June and July in San Francisco and Chicago, the Grateful Dead played what were billed as their final concerts ever. The sold-out shows came 2 decades after guitarist and de facto group leader Jerry Garcia died of a heart attack. But now it appears that we might not have seen the last of the Dead. Group members Bob Weir, Mickey Hart, and Bill Kreutzmann are teaming with guitarist and singer John Mayer for a new tour called Dead and Company. Mayer has been rehearsing with the group in San Rafael, California. He says the idea came from the way he and some Dead members meshed when he hosted the Late Late Show in February.
Bob and I played on that show and then started to play together up here. And before long, it revealed itself as something that was organic and musical and vital and made sense and really kind of tore down all of the labels and boundaries and stigmas for everybody. And that's what music is supposed to do in the first place. It becomes ultimate truth. Everything goes out the window, and it becomes ultimate truth when we start playing, you know.
Bob Weir says that when he and Mayer played together, there was a communication between the musicians that he wanted to see continue.
And I couldn't help but notice that John was listening to what I was playing. He had learned the songs. I expected that, but he was listening to what I was playing, and he was answering that. And it was fun. And it's just so, more fun than, you know, that I was really going to be happy about just walking away from. So we got to talking, and stuff started rolling.
Percussionist Mickey Hart says that while the show is aimed at the band's diehard fans, the players also get something from performing together again.
Well, it's not just for the fans. It is for the fans, but it's for us, too.
Remember, these songs are a part of us, and we feel like we want to play them, and we think they're important enough to play. And as long as it feels good and people want to listen to it and want to come to the concerts and bathe in that experience, you can't say no, nor should you.
And for those fans, some of whom paid thousands of dollars to the supposed final shows earlier this year, Mayer says he thinks that they will be glad the band is playing again, despite the cost.
I don't think there's anybody who bought a ticket to go to the Fare-Thee-Well shows and said, I hope this is really it. I just don't know of any deadhead in the world who said, when I paid my money, I paid to see these guys finish this.
Right.
Trucking, got my chips cashed in, keep trucking.
The band also announced that 5,000 fans will have the chance to win two tickets each to a free November 7th concert at Madison Square Garden in New York. Dead & Company begins its nationwide tour October 29th at the Times Union Center in Albany, New York. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
That'll do it for this edition of International Edition. There's more news and information on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This month marks the 9th anniversary of the murder of renowned Russian journalist Anna Politkovskaya. She was shot and killed in the elevator of her apartment building for exposing human rights abuses in Chechnya. In June 2014, a Moscow court convicted 5 men for the 2006 murder of Ms. Politkovskaya and sentenced them to between 12 and 20 years in prison. Despite these convictions and the 2012 conviction of Dmitry Polyuchenkov for organizing the murder, the identity of the person who ordered Politkovskaya's killing remains unknown. The United States urges the Russian government to bring to justice those who ordered this crime. According to the latest State Department human rights report, there was no progress in establishing accountability in a number of other high-profile killings of journalists, including the 2004 killing of Paul Klebnikov in Moscow and the 2009 killing of Natalia Estyemirova in Chechnya. Additional journalists murdered in recent years in the North Caucasus include Timur Kwachyev, Akhmednabi Akhmednabiev, and Kazbek Gakiev. Russian journalists and bloggers who have uncovered various forms of government malfeasance continue to face harassment, either in the form of direct threats to their physical safety or threats to their security or livelihood, often through legal prosecution. By passing new repressive laws and selectively employing existing ones, the Russian government systematically harasses, discredits, prosecutes, imprisons, detains, and fines individuals and entities that engage in activities critical of the government. The Russian government has fined selected non-governmental institutions and stigmatized them by adding them to a list of registered foreign agents. Most recently, an appeals court upheld a $10,000 legal fine against Human Rights Center Memorial, one of Russia's best-known independent human rights groups. The arbitrary use and the abuse of the Russian legal system have created a climate of fear and self-censorship in Russia and put journalists and human rights defenders at risk. The United States supports the fundamental right of all Russians to free expression and assembly and calls on the Russian government to do the same.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. We'll be right back.
is 4.